When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
For a lot of people, the heart and soul of America is a lot closer to, you know, Orlando than it is to, you know, Washington.
Hi, I'm Rocco Castoro, and this is the Vice Podcast. Here today with filmmaker Randy Moore, whose project Escape from Tomorrow has caused a lot of brouhaha about Disney. The film takes place at Disney World. It's a fantasy horror film. At least I think that's what people have tagged it. I don't know if that's what you call it, but how would you describe it?
I would say that's accurate. Yeah. There are horrific elements, and it is a fantasy, so, you know, it goes through a bunch of different genres, but I would say fantastical family romp through the happiest place on earth.
And it was entirely shot covertly at Disney World, Disneyland?
We started off in Orlando. We shot there for 11 days, and then we went to Anaheim and shot there for 2 weeks. Mm. And we did a lot of scouting beforehand, which actually made it into the picture, and as well as we went back in the spring after their Christmas decorations went down and got additional footage.
Mm. And the entire film was shot in monochrome?
It was.
And
it really was shot in monochrome, too, because the cameras we used, the Canon 5D Mark II, we didn't have external monitors. Otherwise, we could have, you know, shot it in color and then just made the monitor black and white. But due to that limitation, we wanted to be able to see, you know, what it would look like on the LCD screen in the back of the camera. So, and they weren't, I don't know if the new ones are, but they didn't have like a raw setting where, you know, you can go back and change stuff afterwards. So it actually bakes the monochrome image into the media. And you know, you can't go back to color after that. So we committed, you know, first day to black and white, which was a scary proposition for some of the actors who didn't really think the film would ever see the light of day to begin with. But when they heard it was going to be done in black and white, we're like, I think maybe ready to walk.
Oh, yeah.
This was before The Artist had come out, too, so there hadn't been a black and white film that had, you know, any notoriety for a long time, really.
Well, and I think it's fitting because, one, it makes Disney World, the park, Disneyland, more surreal, taking away the color. And two, it's almost like the film itself, I'll try to do a good job of summarizing the storyline, but it is a family visiting Disney World or Disneyland. It's unclear in the film.
Sort of a hybrid. I mean, we want people to think it's Florida, but, you know, obviously if you've been to the parks, you can tell which ones are which.
But it's very, you know, they come, the father gets a call the first day, is there, and is laid off from his job. So it already, I don't know if he's like, if your father was like my dad, but the last thing he wanted to do was to go and stand in line in Disney World. Most dads I see, when I have been there since, or any theme parks, they're just like, I want to go to Epcot so I can drink. So you've got those elements there that everyone really can relate to, or at least most people in America. But it almost gets inside of his mind. He's keeping the secret that he just got, you know, let go. He keeps seeing these two young French women, underage French women, who it's, you know, it's unclear, and at least in the beginning, if he's kind of perving out on him. He's not having a great time with his wife, it seems, at times, and they're dealing with the kids. So you've got all these, you know, undercurrents that you take and then subvert, and then it turns into a conspiracy movie almost. I don't want to give away too much, but where did the first idea for that come? I mean, obviously, Disney World and Disney was a major part of it, but how did you think to kind of write this movie on top of what is a family romp, as you called it?
Well, I went there almost religiously with my father as a child. He lived in Orlando, and my mother lived in Chicago, so I would fly down and visit him every summer, starting from about the age of three. And it became our ritual going to the park, and we spent a lot of time there, and it got to the point where I really associated him with that park, you know, and the park with him too. So when I got older and stopped eventually going to the park, and our relationship sort of fell by the wayside, it wasn't until I went back with my own kids that all of a sudden, you know, all of these like emotions and complicated feelings I had towards him sort of resurfaced, and it, you know, those rides can be kind of like time machines because you're, you know, riding the same rides you were riding when you were a kid, except, you know, obviously now you have your own kids, but I felt like he was sort of haunting me, you know, while I was on these rides, and it became a very like surreal experience, you know, being back in this place that, you know, for me, it was like going back to your, I guess, childhood bedroom or something like that. And, you know, it was really, really strange and surreal again. So that was the initials kind of spark. But then on that same trip, when I went back with my wife and kids for the first time, I realized that for her, it was a completely different experience than it was for me. She wasn't born in the U.S., so she didn't grow up going to the parks, and she really wasn't even, you know, super familiar with the character. She's from the former Soviet Union, so they have their own characters, I guess. And
their statues are a little different.
Yeah. And so, there was a moment where we were at this princess fair, and you know, kids were just screaming and demanding $30 plastic wands from their parents, and everyone was, you know, running around trying to, you know, cater to their kids and give them the best day possible. And just, you know, it was hot and humid. It was August in Florida, which is when there are the most people and the lines are it's the worst time to go, but it's when everyone goes for some reason. And she turned to me. She's a nurse, and sometimes she floats floors at the hospital. And she said, "This is worse than working the psych floor at the hospital." And I was actually angry at first when she said that, because I was like, "What? How can you not be having, you know, a wonderful time? We paid to come here and have, you know, a great time, and you're not enjoying it." So, but then I started thinking about it, and looking at it, you know, through her eyes. And I started to realize, like, for most of us who grew up in going to these parks, and it really is like a rite of passage for so many Americans, like, you know, the trip to Disney or Disneyland, you know, I imagine more people probably do it than, you know, go to the nation's capital or whatever.
Oh, for sure.
So that's why I always say, like, those parks have transcended being just, you know, your average theme park. You know, they mean so much more to a lot of people. You know, you could even, for some people, it's like a religious experience going there. But to get back to what I was saying, like, I realized when you go on those rides, you're sort of in between two worlds. If you've had that experience as a child, you're riding them as an adult, of course, but you're also remembering, you know, when you were a child. And I think the two play off each other. And so she didn't have that nostalgia from her childhood to draw on when we were, you know, going, you know, or when we were waiting in line for an hour, you know, to get on the Jungle Cruise ride or whatever like that. You know, or when we were actually even on the ride, you know, she was just riding it from a totally objective, like, this is, you know, odd. Why are the animals all fake? And, you know, it was just strange for her. And then I saw, I slowly, like, you know, I started to see the crack, you know, the spell wore off of me, and I started to see the cracks in the veneer a little bit more. And you know, I was looking around and became more of an observer than a tourist. Mm. And then I started going back. It wasn't like right away. I was like, Eureka, I'm going to write my next script here. But I just kept thinking about this, and then the time I spent there as a child with my father. And I just almost as an exercise started, you know, writing scenes in script form. That's how I usually write now. And slowly, you know, they just, it came together. It wasn't like I even imagined I would ever actually make this movie, and I certainly didn't think anyone else would ever make this movie, but it was, you know, just this cathartic writing exercise to sort of get it off my chest. You know, when I was stuck on other projects, I would always return to this. And then I finished it, I put it away for a while. I worked on something else, but I kept thinking about this one script, and it wasn't until I was introduced to that camera, the Canon 5D Mark II, that I started thinking, well, maybe there's a way I can make this. And it started small. It started me going into the park, or I thought I would go into the park with a few of my friends and just shoot it, just to sort of get back into, you know, the swing of directing, because I hadn't directed anything since film school. Mm. And I thought it would be really, you know, easy to do. We, you know, had our location, we'd just go in there and shoot. You know, and it's a camera that everyone else has too. It's not especially, you know, there's no special modifications or anything like that. It's small. You know, it's easy to handle. It can be hard to focus because it has a large sensor, so the depth of field is very shallow. So focusing was an issue, and it can get a little shaky. But aside from that, it produces these images that are so beautiful and cinematic that I thought, this is a way we can make this movie and not make it look like someone's home movie, because that was my biggest fear, was that it would look like a home video, and I can barely watch my own home videos, you know, with the family that I love going to the park, let alone watch someone else's home video.
Well, and yeah, and I think what's interesting about monochrome, and it, you know, at first you almost look at it and you're like, wait, is this like supposed to be a surveillance camera or something? Quickly it becomes apparent that mm-hmm. it's shot with intent, and like, but at the same time, it's almost like this specter is hovering around this family, especially because things start to kind of, mm-hmm. you know, hallucinations occur. Maybe they aren't hallucinations, you're right. Not really sure. And it gets back to what you were saying also about kind of childhood. I feel it's like, you know, there's different ways of looking at these things, and the camera in this aspect is pretty objective, so it's getting inside kind of just the minds of the subjects, of the characters. And then what you find is, when you go to Disney World or any theme park, really, if you see kids that are too young to be there, to be on the rides, mm-hmm. it freaks them out. They cry.
Yeah.
And a few years later, then they're filled with joy. And I feel like maybe it reverts when you get a little older, too, where you see it's scary. I mean, why are these animals talking to me? Like, why is, you know, why is Mr. Toad so wild? Like, those kind of things. I can see that element. But you've tapped on it, and it's obviously gotten a lot of attention, probably much more than you would think. But and not, you know, as far as I know, nothing negative necessarily from Disney or anyone.
We haven't heard anything from Disney yet.
And it's interesting. I don't know if I'm sure someone made the comparison, because I got it from somewhere, but the Streisand effect, is that something you were talking about?
I wasn't talking about it. I read, you know, people were mentioning that. Yeah. And there's a lot of speculation as to, you know, why they've chosen to remain silent on this film. And so, I don't really have an opinion. I, you know, if they want to not say anything, that's great. I don't want to spend years in, you know, litigation. That's the last thing I want to do. And
well, speaking with someone, I mean, the Streisand effect, like, is just so we're clear. It's the Barbara Streisand had a house, I think it was on the coast of Malibu, beautiful coastline somewhere. There was a, I believe it was the photographers doing aerial shots to document the coastline to show erosion. And her lawyers demanded, Streisand's lawyers demanded that the images be pulled off. That caused a couple photos that, you know, 10 people had looked at mm-hmm. before that gave her location, apparently, but no one would have known that. And then it became a big news story because she decided, she's like, I want it down, mm-hmm. which now everyone knows for your houses. So someone said to me, if Disney were smart, they'd buy it. But obviously, that's probably not going to happen. I hope it does for your sake. I guess what I'm saying is, like, you've, in not a malicious way whatsoever, is definitely not as, well, it's a different type of subversion than people like Paul McCarthy and these people that are really playing with Disney's imagery in kind of sordid ways. I guess there's a bit of that there, but I feel like you've kind of nailed, like, the psychology of the most fucked up American families in this movie. Like, were you aiming for anything like that?
I mean, I wanted it to actually feel what, to portray on screen what it feels like to go there and have just an awful, awful day, you know? And I wanted to, you know, to use, you know, surrealism and to help get you inside the head and not, you know, not just show it, but also actually make the audience, you know, have like a feel like they're inside the characters' heads and seeing what they're feeling while they were watching the picture. So that was the intention.
What was it like your first day of shooting? I imagine you did some test shoots and you said you did some scouting.
We did a lot of scouting and we walked through the whole movie with the camera department about 9 times before we ever brought any cast in. So we, you know, just us with the cameras, we were pretty comfortable. It was still, you know, it was always, we knew we could be discovered, but bringing the cast in changed everything, and that was terrifying the first time we went into the park with them. And I had a friend who told me to shoot the hardest scenes first. You know, the riskiest scenes, the scenes that were in the most, you know, populated areas. And so the first shot we did is the scene where the family's walking up towards Spaceship Earth, which is the big geodesic sphere in Epcot. And we had all 4 actors walking towards this. Logistically, it was tough. We had the 4 main actors and the family walking up towards the ball, and behind them we had our cameraman sitting on a wheelchair being pushed, following them, you know, as they approached it. And we also had another family, this sort of like nemesis family, coming up from the side. So there was a lot of coordination involved. And then, you know, they were all mic'd, and this is the first time they were really acting inside the park. And, you know, I always say this was like an experimental movie in the sense that we really didn't know if we could make the movie every day. You know, we didn't know if it was going to be our last day of shooting. So this was the moment when I was, you know, we were all like, can we actually do this now? You know, we knew we could go and film stuff, mm-hmm. but we didn't know if we could then, you know, work with actors in this environment, or if the actors could even, you know, maintain their sanity and deliver, you know, performances. But like, as the lead actor likes to say, you know, when he's interviewed, he's like, I was acting for my life. So I think, you know, in a lot of ways it really helped their performances because they had to be natural and, you know, fit in. Mm.
And, I mean, you know, it seems like almost an insurmountable challenge when you think about, okay, we're going to go shoot this narrative feature in these real-life parks with people all around, and we have to stay completely off the radar or else we're going to get ejected. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, that sounds like a particularly difficult scene, but there's some other scenes where I'm like, yeah, no, I bet no one was bothering. It just looks like a family, and like no one's paying attention to this insane stuff this guy's saying, or like him looking at that girl's butt, but I bet that happens anyway, you know?
Yeah, there were actually a lot of Roys looking at, you know, the French girls when they were walking around, so it was kind of strange to see, you know, we would say, okay, go there, and, you know, all, dads from all over were just, you know, Googling them. So, you know, we felt we tapped into something that, you know, mm-hmm. happens quite often. But, yeah, you know, luckily at the park, cameras are ubiquitous. Everyone has one. You know, we, I think, would have looked out of place if we didn't have a camera with us.
So we, did you guys have earpieces or something? Were you communicating?
We used our phones. And, well, when I communicated with the actors, I would just walk up and subtly, you know, talk to them. And that usually the camera guys would be back here. They already knew, you know, what the shot was. We had shot lists on our phones, too. Every shot in the film was on that list, and mm-hmm. we got pretty much all our shots. Our AD scheduled the shoot, you know, wonderfully. He was a big Disney fan, too, so he probably could have mapped it out, you know, in his head without even going on the location scouts. But he had us running. We were always chasing the sun, so it wouldn't be like, you know, so we wouldn't be shooting in front of the castle and it wouldn't be blown up in the background behind us. So he had us running back and forth from, you know, one side of the park to the other. And especially in Orlando, those parks are vast. So we had to get wheelchairs for the kids so, you know, they wouldn't be, you know, exhausted at the end of the day.
I think most children probably arrive at Disneyland or Magic Kingdom, and their reactions are, by and large, probably going to be the same first few times or the first time they experience it. But as adults who bring their children there, you've been so many times, you've seen so many parkgoers. Mm-hmm. Like, is there a common thread that runs underneath? Like, do some people not take their kids to Disney, and it's just this group of people, and we don't see that, or is it like just everyday Americans, like they want everyone to think?
It really is. I mean, I think if you want to see America, you know, in its
a microcosm.
It's there. You know, there are a lot of large waistbands. There are a lot of people who've just given up on walking altogether. The scooter.
Their legs work, but they've given up on walking.
Well, it's easier, right? I guess. You see a whole range of emotions there. I mean, you see the entire. You know, you see people having the greatest day of their life, and you see people just ready to murder each other. And you think, you know, why did they even come? Because everyone is miserable. You know, people go there with like a war plan of like, we're gonna, you know, hit this ride and this ride and this ride, and we have to, you know, get to here so we can see the fireworks at night. And if there's any deviation, you know, you can see, you know, just the whole family unit falling to pieces, and it's sad. I mean, people just want to have, I guess, a great time there, and their expectations are so high, you know. And sometimes, I'm, you know, probably more than not, they're met, but a lot of times, you know, it doesn't end pretty.
Well, I guess, like, you saw the cracks in the park kind of through your wife's eyes. It could also reveal the cracks in like a family unit or structure.
It does. You know? I mean, it's a hyper reality there, and everything is like, you know, everyone's ultra sensitive to everything. So, you know, the littlest thing will just set off, you know.
A mob.
Yeah, a mob. And there's something about, you know, going there that I think is comforting for a lot of people. First of all, obviously, it reminds them of their childhood, and they want to, you know, basically kind of revert back to the womb or the safety they had as a child, and it's like it's the ultimate nanny state, you know. What could go wrong there? It's safe. Why go to Europe, you know, and get, you know, your wallet stolen when you could go to the International Pavilion at Epcot and hit all those cities in, you know, a few hours,
right?
And
super fast.
Yeah,
but I mean. And then you've got, when I first heard of the movie, I didn't know of how much you'd integrate the hotels and the surrounding areas of, not just the theme parks, mm-hmm. which has always been the weird thing to me, is you've got like Celebration at Disneyland,
right.
Which is a fake, like,
I think
main,
it's defunct now.
Is it defunct?
It used to be a real
neighborhood.
I went there, so it's, right? That was really interesting.
It was, but your movie reminded me, like, I've been there once, it's like, you know, it's like Main Street USA, yeah. Literally, it's like.
It's people, you know, who wanted to live at Disney World, who like could not get enough and just said, I want to live there. And there are people like that. One of the strangest things we saw when we were shooting early one morning, we were at Epcot, and there was sort of a sweet, portly couple that were laying down on the ground in front of the geodesic sphere, taking a nap, and it just and hold like in a full embrace. Mm-hmm. And people were walking by security; no one was stopping them. And I don't know if they were on their honeymoon or if they were just in love or just so happy to be in Epcot. But
maybe they took some ecstasy or something.
Possibly, mm-hmm. But you know, you realize like this is their fantasy come true. They just wanted to lie down in you know underneath this ball in this place because you know it meant so much to them. And there's another story about this show called the name of the show is Fantasmic, and I took my family there, and you know Mickey's battling all the Disney villains. And then at one point, he sort of disappears and then reappears in his Sorcerer's Apprentice costume at the top of this mountain. And, you know, it happens, you know, at the same time with all these explosions and fire and lasers and music crescendos. And when he appeared, there was just this audible gasp through the entire audience, mostly adults, it was like a religious experience for them, as if they were witnessing the second coming. And I was like, this character, you know, this mouse has taken on so much meaning for these people. You know, these are grown adults. I mean, they were, you could see they had, you know, chills running down their spines when this happened. And I was like, wow, this place, you know, it's like a corporate religion.
How many times did you have to visit the park all told from, you know, the first time you were like, we're going to try to shoot this to the final scene that you filmed? On average, I mean, I know you're not going to be able to tell me the exact number.
I mean, initially it was going to be me with some friends of mine, and I was going to shoot it myself. So I was, and even when I was writing it, I was going with my daughters, you know, sort of just looking around and trying to find interesting things. So I would say, I mean, since I thought about actually making a film there, I probably went there at least 35.
Wow.
Maybe more.
And that's just the Magic Kingdom? Times. That's just Orlando? Or is that both combined?
That's probably both combined.
35?
Yeah. I don't think I could have.
So that's a total. You've probably been there like 60, 70 times?
During
the your lifetime.
Oh, in my lifetime, yeah. I'm probably way more
way
than
more
that.
Than that?
Yeah, because like I said, I mean, my father and I used to, just go there every day in the summer.
Oh, literally every day. Oh,
not
sorry.
Every day, but a lot.
Jeez, and you didn't? Did you have any close calls? Did you get caught ever by the security?
The only close call we had was at the end of our park shooting schedule, which was just fortunate for us that it had been scheduled at the end. The actors had a scene where it's not in the final cut of the film, but they had to go enter through the turnstiles, and if we had shot the film sequentially, obviously we would have done this like right, you know, at the top of the shooting schedule, but it wasn't, you know, something we thought would be an easy shot, so we waited until the end of production to grab it, and we had them enter and exit about three times, you know, so we could get multiple angles. And after the third time, security personnel walked over and asked, you know, why have you just entered and exited the park three times? And the actor said, oh, I think we forgot our sunscreen or something. And then he said, well, are you a celebrity? And he said, no, why would you ask that? He's like, because you have paparazzi following you. And at that point, I realized they thought our camera guys were paparazzi. And initially, when we started filming, I made them shave their beards and dress conservatively. But I think by this time, it was towards the end of the shoot, they had sort of, you know, gotten really comfortable and reverted back to their normal like LA film, you know, attire. So they said, well, no, we don't know who those people are. And I think they thought something was off about that. So they said, well, come with us. And they pulled them aside and they took them over to where like the firehouse is on Main Street. I said, wait here for a second, we're gonna check something out. And right when they said that, the kids said they needed to go to the bathroom. And so they said, all right, take your kids to the bathroom, but when you're done, come right back here. So they went to the bathroom, they took off their sound equipment, and when they came out again, a parade had come by as you know, happens every 15 minutes in Disneyland that basically cut them off from the security personnel waiting on the other side of the street. And basically the lead actress loves to say they just paraded on out of there with the parade, and we had our production band waiting at the entrance, and we got in and we drove away, and we did like evasive maneuvers through downtown Anaheim in case we had some like unmarked Disney tail to shake. Mm-hmm. But that was the last day we went into the park with the cast. Had that happened during the beginning of the shoot, I think everyone would have been too freaked out.
Yeah.
The movie wouldn't have happened at all.
And how did you cast this? Was it traditional in the beginning?
Traditional indie film casting. Mm-hmm. We cast both in LA and in New York.
Mm-hmm. And no one was like, no one when you told them and you had selected your final cast, and you're like, actually, or did they know? Like, there was going to be shot?
No one knew when we were just casting. As soon as, you know, someone became, you know, in competition for the role, then we said, look, here's what we're going to do. You know, are you on board? And, you know, 99% of the time, they were, yeah.
Mm. And you came out of Sundance, got a lot of attention when you came out. Did that freak you out in terms of Disney dropping the hammer, or didn't know what was going to happen?
We didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah. We didn't know if we would get, you know, a second screening at Sundance. You know, I was thinking this projector would be shut down in the middle of the first screening, let alone all of our screenings. And Sundance eventually even added a second press and industry screening. So we got all our screenings plus that. So that was amazing. And then we still didn't really know, you know, what was going to happen for a while. But then we started for the first time betting the film with lawyers.
I see.
And basically, you know, morally, I always thought, because of the fact that this place, like I said, has transcended being just another theme park, and, you know, it means so much to so many people. It's, you know, almost like going there is like going to church for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, so much a part of our culture, to not be able to comment on it or critique it or parody it just seemed wrong. I felt, you know, like morally, you know, I should be able to say this about, you know, this huge empire that, you know, that's so ubiquitous and is just everywhere in our culture. You can't escape it. But legally, I didn't, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I didn't crack open law books and start, you know, seeing what, you know, what was I could do and what I couldn't do. And I didn't want to do that either. I didn't want to, like, change the, you know, I wanted to have one pure cut of the film before any legal, you know, people came in and started, you know, chipping away at it. Yeah, I didn't want to second guess what, you know, might be acceptable and what might not be acceptable. But, you know, I think, and I also thought, I always felt that the film, you know, should fall under the fair use doctrine as a parody, and we still feel that way, and that's our main legal counsel believes that, and basically that's what led us to get E&O insurance and, you know, grab distribution.
And did they make you remove anything that was particularly...
We didn't have to remove any Disney things. All we had to do was add a disclaimer. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the film, yeah. And we cut the film down from the Sundance version mostly for just editorial reasons. By then, the picture had been locked for, like, almost a year, and it was kind of a scary prospect to open it up. We would have had to redo a lot of sound design, and then we actually had a film print of the film that we showed at Sundance, 35mm print. We did a film out in South Korea, which is where we did all our post-production.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we would have had to go back and, you know, do another scan out to film, and it was just a big, you know, to do. So it wasn't until after Sundance that our sales agent, you know, said, well, since we're going to have to add a disclaimer and, you know, maybe you might want to go in and, you know, chop it down, make it tighter, which is, you know, because obviously at that point I've been watching it for a year. There were so many things that I would have loved to have changed if it was, you know, really easy to do. But then all of a sudden I had the opportunity and I couldn't, and I was so grateful.
did you think you'd actually get distribution? And like, how did you think you might have to screen it when you were first, or did you not really care because you made it and that was enough?
Initially, I thought, you know, it was a tiny black and white independent movie. Mm-hmm. I thought it might have a life, you know, in a minor festival circuit. And then after that, I thought it'd probably be like driving around in a van, you know, projecting it onto walls with a tip jar, asking sure. for donations if anyone, you know, enjoyed the film. I thought that was about as far as it would go.
Hmm. And the poster is kind of a Mickey hand, right? Or a Mickey glove?
It's not Mickey's.
It's not, whose hand is it?
It's just a hand.
Sorry. The poster is a gloved hand.
Yes.
It looks cartoonish in a way that many cartoons have gloves like that.
That's right.
Mice sometimes wear them too, I think. Cartoon mice. But it's, you know, it's provocative. And I think people have written about the poster a lot too. Mm-hmm. And your stance is like, we're not trying to like kind of take the piss out of Disney or anything. And it doesn't, if you watch the movie, it's not true. It just happens to take place in Disney World, which is a real place, but it's also not. So it's got all these different levels of things going on. Like, it seems like you were really careful to keep it, I don't know if it was secret, trying to keep it secret from Disney in the post-production phase, and you know, the fact that they've said nothing is almost spookier than them thinking you're going after them. I don't mean to get spooked out.
Well, I knew we didn't want to do our VFX and post-production like in Burbank.
Right.
You know, I thought that would definitely be a big mistake. So when our editor suggested, you know, going to South Korea, where she's from and has a lot of connections in the film industry, not only did it make like really good financial sense, it kind of let me sit back and, you know, take a deep breath, because finally, you know, we were getting out of LA.
Yeah.
I kept making backups of all the hard drives that we had all our footage on, because I was just worried that, you know, basically, my house was going to be raided. Everything was going to be taken. So it wasn't until like we had hard drives, you know, in South Korea and, you know, at my DP's house and in my closet that I sort of felt a little more relaxed.
And well, that's the thing, is that is another thing that's surprising with the film is, in the beginning, you might not think there'd be any sort of visual effects, and increasingly there's lots of, I mean, CGI, I guess, or...
Yeah, there's CGI, there's a lot of green screen, which was, we always planned on having mm-hmm. green screen. You know, we wanted it to have sort of like this 50s processed shot
sure.
Aesthetic to it, to add to the black and white.
But there's just some very modern, I guess, we'll say, filmmaking techniques, stuff you might see maybe in a Disney movie, maybe not a cartoon, but... used in a variety of ways. I just that surprised me for some reason. I knew it was coming, I guess, but uh-huh. it takes it even one step further into some, obviously, some surreal place. Where, like, when the actors had to kind of fake that, uh-huh. when the effects weren't happening, I mean, were any patrons or any fellow guests like being like, what the hell's going on?
Well, most of the big effect shots we shot in on a soundstage,
okay.
And I do think that it was more difficult for the actors to you know, perform on the green screen stages or even on the sets than when they were in the park, because they had, you know, so much to work off of in the park. So even though, as you know, a filmmaker, it was much easier for me to, you know, be in that environment and to, you know, have total control over everything, because the park was just, you know, it was so chaotic. It's the worst, you know, possible place to make a movie, really. But I felt out the actors were a lot more believable in the park.
In the park, yeah. Well, that makes sense. So what's your favorite ride at Disney World?
I like Spaceship Earth, the ride that's in the geodesic sphere. And I've always liked that since I was a kid.
Do you remember the first time you went inside the dome?
I think so. I mean, I just remember just having...
Just going.
Yeah, going.
And it's interesting you say that. I mean, did you like Epcot?
I did like Epcot a lot. Yeah.
The educational park.
You know, I was never into like the fairies and the fantasy land and all that stuff, but I liked that, you know, vision of the future that Epcot used to be. It's sort of a little shabby now, but
is it they haven't kept up on?
They could probably, it could use a little updating.
Well, because it is the future now, and they're like, we predicted it. Well, that's interesting, because I'm thinking a lot of kids, it's their least favorite park.
I know, that's what's, I've heard that.
Well, it's just so, it's kind of impersonal, because you don't see, like, their symbols, this giant monolith, like, it's a monolithic, it's almost oppressive, this giant ball.
It is oppressive, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for coming in today. Hopefully, you know, the mouse and all his friends treat you kindly. I think they will. They just see the movie. So, maybe you can do a gorilla screening inside the park. I'm just kidding. I'm going to that. But great
thanks,
to meet you.
Thanks, Rocco.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.